Okay. All right. Well, I'm just going to go down this list of questions, and we'll do whatever we can do and whatever y'all feel like doing. And if you want to pass, you know, that's cool too. So the first one I have is, I think Kelly shared a little bit about some of her experience with this. But how do you do the third step? Anybody want to take that question? How do you do the third step?
Sarah, you want to jump in?
Sure. So personally for me, I think it's this is just my experience, and I think all Q&As are good because experience is experience. Like, my experience might be different than somebody else's, but that's the beauty of experience. It's your own. Like, it's an unshakable truth. Like, no one can be like, no, that's not your experience. You know, like, your experience is your experience. So you have that benefit. Understanding that my experience with it might be a little bit different. It's kind of like circumstances. Like, circumstances are different. So for me, like, I remember when I was in rehab, I thought that I did a third step. I really believe that I had done a third step when I just got on my knees and I prayed and I said the third step prayer and I said that I was turning everything, like, I'm making the decision for today to do it. And then when I would wake up every day, I would say, I'm going to try to give over my will and my life over. That's what it looked like at the beginning of my sobriety. So it was just making that decision, and I would tell God, like, okay, I'm going to try to make the decision today to turn my will and my life over. So that was earlier in sobriety. Over time, though, like a year into sobriety, a third step, what it looked like for me was pushing through the rest of the steps. And now what a third step is for me, how I do my third step is I continue in really a lot of 6 and 7 and 11. It's a lot of prayer. It's a lot of reminding myself that there is a bigger plan, that I have let God, I have said that I am going to let God and these principles of AA come into every area of my life, not just God, not just AA, like not just my drinking. And I shared a little bit about it in my story, you know, especially like with this having a kid, you know, like having a baby, that is an area where it's like, I am like, nope, this is, we have doctors and this is what they're telling us. And, you know, we go here and this is the next step. And there has been at times absolutely like not letting God into that and understanding that that's something I literally have no physical control. Like, I have no control over the science of like all of that. But what I do have control over is how I react to it and how I treat the people around me. And that to me is the third step, is am I going to allow the principles of AA into my life today? Sometimes it's hour by hour. Sometimes it's decision by decision. Sometimes it's meeting by meeting at work. Like, am I going to walk into this meeting with a good attitude, knowing that like I have to be an example? So that's what it looks like today. I think mine has changed over time, but the general kind of net of it all is, whether it's in a prayer or to somebody like next to me or in a meeting, it's the recommitment that I am going to allow God into my life and understand that I can control my actions living by principle, but the outcome is part of the bigger plan and up to that guy.
Great answer.
Do you have anything on that, Kelly? Want to pass? Where
yeah.
are we going?
Yeah, I mean, every day I wake up with alcoholism, and my sponsor is always like, God first. Now, that is not what happens. I wake up, and the first thing I do is touch my phone, because that's how I wake up. And then I touch my phone, and then there's inevitably, you know, text messages and Instagram and Facebook and emails. And I usually look at all that stuff as I'm making my coffee, and then I turn it off. But I do know, I'm convinced that I have got to invite this power in, or I just do not do well. I have to have that power. It feels very scientific to me. Like, okay, she said it's God first, but I've already gone to the bathroom and, you know, made the coffee and checked the emails and done all the things. Now I need to get quiet and recommit. And I do that. And I love how Sarah answered that question with, you know, what am I bringing to this equation? I don't know what that noise was, but that sounded great.
So
that was my time. That was my time to be quiet.
Okay, thank you so much. All right. The second question is, why is having a job in AA so important? Why is having a job in AA so important?
Do we mean job like pay my bills or job like service position? I mean, both are great.
In AA. It looks like to me it's a service question.
Okay.
I'm sure the other part is significant too, right?
Also very bills, important.
Yeah, okay. But, being self-supporting through your own contributions. Okay, that's cool too. We got that. But yeah, it says having a job in AA is so important. So however you feel, you can relate to that.
So for me personally, and again, the easiest relatable experience is what I'm going through right now. So for instance, like with everything that's going on, I need service commitments because it's that extra layer of I have accountability that I need to be somewhere. Whether I'm not feeling, if I'm depressed that day or I'm feeling a little extra sad or I just don't want to. Like having that service position means I have a responsibility to be somewhere to do something. And one of the principles that my sponsor really, really dug into me is that the first thing that you can start doing to start changing your life is you do what you say you're going to do and you be where you say you're going to be when you say you're going to be there. And just that little principle had changed kind of everything for me, whether it was being at a meeting, whether it's at work. Like if I say I'm going to be at a 10 o'clock meeting, I better be there at 9:58 because I'm supposed, showing up to doctor's appointments, giving myself enough time so I'm not chronically late. It's showing up. Showing up has been the thing that has changed my sobriety the most. And so service commitments in AA have helped to really push that principle into all areas of my life. And it's just an extra layer for me. And for someone who is especially, I can find the dark a lot. I'm someone where, I am inherently dark on the inside. It's so surprising. Like most people are like, really? You're so like bubbly and like sunshine. And I'm like, yes, I am. And that is truly a benefit and a byproduct of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm the person that I love, not that this matters, but I like watching murder crime shows, dark stuff, not really, I fall asleep to Criminal Minds.
Me too.
Yeah, I'm naturally someone conspiracy theories and dark, everybody's out to get you, dog eat dog world. Like naturally that was who I was and how I was. And so, having service commitments really pushed where Joyce, she was like, I don't care if you feel depressed today. You said you were going to go be at the meeting to make coffee. Go to the meeting and make coffee. Like you can be depressed and make coffee. Depression doesn't hurt your hands. You can still show up and make coffee. You can drive, go do your thing. And so service actually has been extremely beneficial, not only in that, but in that, where it's somewhere where I need to be. It's also been beneficial in the fact that sometimes it pulls me out of pulls me up by my bootstraps and gets me there. And the last piece of this that I'll say is that I always heard the term, someone with a lot of time told me, I always heard the term when I was new in sobriety, meeting makers make it, meeting makers make it. So I was like, oh my God, okay, I'm going to go to 50 bajillion meetings. If I'm upset about something or if something is going on, I'm going to go to 50 bajillion meetings. Sure, that there will be benefit in me going to meetings. But I think what I've found is that my experiences over time, what I've started to see is that it's not meeting makers as in people that attend a bajillion meetings. It's the people, that make the meeting, the people that show up and make the coffee, the people that are the, the chairperson for the meeting, passing the baskets. The more important thing is closing up the meeting when we're all tired and ready to go home, putting all the chairs away, picking up any cigarette butts, making sure that the newcomer who waited until 10:59 to ask, oh, wait, I live 4 hours away and I need a ride home, those people that really inconvenience themselves, that service is what they mean when they say meeting makers make it. So that's just my thought on that.
God, I love that. That was awesome. That was a cool take on, sorry, Billy. That was a cool take on meeting makers make it. I love that. That was awesome. Yeah, very, very similar. I think, it was the first, AA is the first thing I ever respected. And so getting a job now the irony is I had all this trouble with money in the past, all this fear about money. So as God would have it, I ended up getting elected an intergroup rep at my old home group, and I got to see how poor Alcoholics Anonymous is and how, like, what I had to look at the budget of who, what meetings donated to what and how much and where AA's operating expenses were. Like, you know, because I personally had problems and fear about money, I got to watch AA operate on a shoestring budget, see where every dollar was accounted for, and start to kind of realize that God's in charge of AA and their money and also my money. I don't know. That was helpful. And then, you know, I'm now the group treasurer, which is just it gives me chills to sit there and, you know, to count the money every quarter when I pay it and pay the intergroup bills and make sure the rent's paid. And what a wonderful, it gives me that lock in that I have to be there. You know, I got to pick up the envelope, you know, on Wednesdays. And, it's just wonderful to be able to be trustworthy, you know, to be somebody that you can count on. That is not something I saw coming when I got here. So yeah. And also, you know, every time I do something for AA or, more doors open, you know, the more I do here, the more conversations I get in, the more I get to see my defects, the more I get to see other people's defects and our assets and how we navigate through those together in a group format. It's kind of neat, you know, personalities. Like, I used to just run when people's personalities didn't align with my own, right? When I'm stuck in a group and I have a service commitment, I got to keep showing up and I got to walk through that place that I might have ordinarily ran from. So all those things are character building and kind of cool. Good question.
Billy, if I can add one more thing, I was just thinking about, I loved what you had to say, Kelly. And I think what it also made me think about too is that a job in AA doesn't necessarily mean, like, we have all these awesome, like, opportunities for these, like, positions like treasurer and, like, heck yes. Like, how, like, people trusting me around their wallets is, like, a brand new experience in AA, you know? Like, and then to have, like, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've had people in meetings who go back out, and then when they come, if they got, you know, if they are able to get back, say, like, oh, yeah, I have to pay this, you know, this AA meeting back because they stole the treasury of a meeting, you know? Like, but that's neither here nor there. Like, God bless them. They're welcome. They are all welcome here. But I think one thing I was thinking about was the fact that another just job in AA, because, like, a lot of times there have been, like, currently, so I left an old job, I got to a new job, and my schedule has been, I'm in taxes. And so right before all of this crazy, you know, like, April 15th is a big day for us. So I had this, and I knew I was going to be working a lot of overtime. And so I was like, I'm not going to take a service position at a meeting, because I know that there's a likelihood that I won't be able to get to that meeting that night. And it's not fair for me to get somebody to cover it for, you know, 90% of my service position. So my sponsor is one who constantly reminds me, and I love this question that it made me think of, like, one of our jobs is to be open to the newcomer, right? So even if you don't have a job, like a coffee position, a job could easily be answering the phone when a newcomer calls, talking them through when they're being extra, you know, like, belligerent. Like, a job is also just carrying the message where you can, being kind where you can, like, living by principles. Like, that's one of our jobs as well, especially in the 12th step with, like, carrying the message to another alcoholic. So if you're one of those people that's like, oh, well, I don't have, like, a service position that's, like, at a meeting right now, like, one of your jobs is also, like, do you share when there's nobody raising their hand at a meeting? Or are you sitting there judging how the meeting has gone real left, and, you know, you're just sitting there with, this is one of my biggest ones. I'll be sitting in a meeting like, these people, they don't listen to them. Like, this meeting has somehow become about, like, your cat dying, you know, like, and I'm sitting there judging the meeting for a whole hour when I could have just raised my hand and shared. I've got experience with it. If you have a day sober, you have experience with the first step. If you're in a meeting, you have experience with the first step. So, like, you can raise your hand and share. So there's a lot to what a job is and how we look at it. We can bring a lot more to it, I think, too. So that was just something that hit me right now.
Cool.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, Sarah. Okay. What is singleness of purpose? What is singleness of purpose? Anybody want to respond to that?
Kelly, you want to take that one?
Yeah, let's take it. that is our code here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have got to be able to outline with the new person, are they alcoholic? Do they have the allergy? I need to stay really close to the integrity of this program and the physician and the steps. So I am not sponsoring out of my head or out of a treatment center or out of another type of literature or out of some other experience. I can stay really close to the book. And part of my job was exactly what my sponsor did for me. I had 20 years sober when she started working with me. And first thing she did was sit me down and qualify that I was alcoholic. She's like, I know you've been in AA for 20 years, but how do you know you're an alcoholic? And it was, I was like, well, she's like, do you have the allergy? Do you have the obsession of the mind and the allergy of the body? How do you know? It was really powerful to think about, you know, my drinking and think about like, yeah, you know, I could not stop once I started. I also did not want to stop. You know, we vetted the fact that I was actually alcoholic mm-hmm. before we went any further together as a sponsor sponsee. And I do that with my sponsees. I also, again, time is my biggest currency. And now I spend time with them. I make sure that we're not just rushing through the work, that we're getting in both. We're getting in the books. We're reading the stuff. You know, we're talking about our drinking. We're making sure that it's aligned with the singleness of purpose that is Alcoholics Anonymous. AA helps me with a whole lot of other things, but if I wasn't an alcoholic, I wouldn't be that interested here. You know, if I didn't have real alcoholism and be pushed by that, I don't need to be here, right? So, want to tap in, Sarah?
Yeah, I love that. And I completely agree. I mean, for me, singleness of purpose goes right back to what it says in our book. It's our primary purpose. What's our primary purpose? To help another sick and suffering alcoholic to carry the message. And I love what you said, Kelly, because something that I have been struggling with talking to my sponsor about is I've had, you know, of the people that I got sober with or that were sober before me, I would say probably about half of them have left. And it's not because and they're like, I'm normal. And some of them are seemingly fine. Some of them are not. But I think it is imperative. And I find this, especially with young people's meetings, that this is not Save the Whales. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. I am not going to try to like force. It's not my job to force anybody to see that they're alcoholic, you know, like. Yes, I can take meetings into institutions. I should take meetings into institutions. I should do service. I should show up at my meeting. If someone is at the meeting, whether they're just checking it out, whether they know they're alcoholic, I need to be able to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's one piece of it, is having the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is in the big book. That it's not my opinion on the big book. It's what's in the actual big book. And I can always say, this is my opinion, you know, that this is my experience. This is my opinion, all of that. So part of it is knowing like what the actual program of AA is. And that means you have to like actually do the program, like work all 12 steps, that. But the other piece of this is that it's, you know, this is not Save the Whales. And, I think it's really easy to sometimes, especially in young people's groups, it's my experience. It's also what I've seen with all of the stuff to do, like the hangouts and the fellowship and all, that's all great and dandy. But if you don't know that you're an alcoholic, there are people that can sometimes fall in and fall into the fun of it and not really be alcoholic. And I think that that is a disservice to AA. I believe that it, you know, like when there are people sharing people's lives on the line, you better know that you need to be here. And not in a like where if you have questions, there have been times in my own sobriety where I thought to myself, you know, maybe it was the drugs. Like maybe I could drink wine like a lady. I never drank wine. Like what if I just drank wine? You see all these like Instagram models at wineries, like with their hats and their boots. Like maybe if I just drank wine like a lady, I would be okay. There have been times in my own sobriety where but that's not the questioning I'm talking about. I mean, this is like the really where it's like you don't qualify to be an Alcoholics Anonymous and you're sort of just hanging about. That's kind of where I think it's really important for us as members who do have that primary purpose, who have been through all the steps, to share our experience, to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and to keep it to that. And I think the other piece of that is in the climate that we live in. And I know, especially for Kelly and I, when being closer to DC, which is a huge political hub, staying out of all that crap, following all the traditions, like not bringing that stuff into the meetings, because that is, I have experience. I just did it this morning. This morning I did it. Somebody was ranting and raving about some craziness on Facebook about a specific thing that I do not, I morally disagree with. And I started writing out this comment. I mean, I was going, I was about to be a keyboard warrior. Like I was ready to go. And then I was like, you know what? They're not worth my time. So I unfriended them. And then I'm, you know, brushing my teeth, you know, sweating, you know, I'm all mad and riled up about it. And then I was like, what are you doing? Like, this is crazy. You're about to go speak, do a speaking engagement. Like, this is crazy. Like, but that's why, one, I try to make sure that even in all my social media avenues and stuff like that, I try to stay out of, I try to follow the traditions, even in those areas of my life where I'm not spewing anything that's sort of outside of it or could cause discord, you know, like, cause I know that I take it personally when other people do it, and I shouldn't, like, I really shouldn't, but I know that I do it. So if I know that I do it, why don't I be, try to be an example of what I would want anyway? So staying out of all that mess is real important for me.
That's awesome. All right, thank you very much. Let's see, we have another question here, and before I read that, I wanted to just remind our list, our other viewers, that you can send a question in via chat. So, you know, be sure and put your chat button, and we'll try to catch and answer. All right, the next question is, how do you know if you have hit bottom? I don't think it's a trick question, but it's a, how do you know if you have hit bottom? Either of you ladies?
I struggle with the word bottom. I do. I struggle with the word bottom because I think that it's different for everybody. You'll hear all the different cliches. I mean, I've heard people that say, you know, you've hit bottom when you stop digging. And some there have been periods in my sobriety where I'm like, that just makes me mad. Like, why, what do you mean? You think I like destroying my life? Like, I would have stopped digging if I could, but it's like, I couldn't because I'm an alcoholic. But I also understand, like, where was the point where it just was like, you stopped. I've also heard that, I've also heard about where your bottom is when you can no longer lower your standards faster than your actions. And I think that's a pretty good sum up of my own experience, but I think it's different if what my experience is, and I'll just speak to my own experiences. I think that it's different for everybody. I don't know that I knew in that moment. I mean, when I was sitting in that bathroom stall, like, I don't know that I necessarily had the conscious thought, like, this is my bottom. I just knew that it felt different. That level of sort of demoralization, it just felt different. And I went to a meeting and I shared honestly. But I had done that before. So I think what your bottom is, it's different for everyone. I think really when I knew it was my bottom was when I was sitting in an AA meeting. That what I would say would be my bottom was when I was sitting in an AA meeting and I knew, oh my God, I actually do have to do this. Like, this is the last house on the block. So I think how you know when you've hit your bottom is when you're actually committed to trying Alcoholics Anonymous.
Right. Yeah, I would second that. I would say that moment when you're willing to do something different, and it's different for every single person, and people you watch just roll around on what I think is their bottom and they should be stepping over on the side and they just can't. But then somebody like some other person can, you know, get the first nip of the ringer by some people's standards and be willing to run and go towards the solution.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's, and you can't give it to them. And it's heartbreaking when you're trying to give somebody sobriety and they don't want it. But, you know, it's at that point, it's all personal for each of us, I think. When are we willing to do something different?
Uh-oh. Billy,
did we lose him?
Muted. I think you're muted somehow, Billy. I think Gary's working to unmute you right now, Billy. Oh, it looks like everybody is muted except for me. Okay. There we go.
Okay. I'll take them back.
Somebody is
okay.
Also muted right now, though, too, just FYI. I can see that Kelly's muted. So, Gary, can you unmute Kelly? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah. We all ready to go?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Why is sponsorship so important? Why is sponsorship so important?
Oh, man.
That's a loaded question.
Good God, that's a good one. You want to go first, Sarah?
Well, I'll tell you, with that question, there's the next question is, how do you sponsor and how are you sponsored? So maybe all that can be one big answer. I don't know. So there you go.
I think the net for me of why is sponsorship so important, like summing it up in one sentence real quick, is because I cannot fix what's broken with something that's broken. And that's why I need a sponsor. Me trying to answer my own questions and fix my own problems never, not one time worked for me in the past. It got me to AA. So why would I think that I could do AA in the same manner? You know, like that's like the definition of insanity. It's like the same as the insanity of the first drink that we talk about. Mm-hmm. Nothing in my life has given me any intuition that I, on my own, can do well with myself, really. So now you're taking away the one coping mechanism I did have, this drinking, and you're telling me to live a better life. I'm not going to be able to do that on my own. Like, that's just not in the realm of reality, which is why sponsorship is so important. Because how can I do something? It's a basic fundamental, like when we're growing up, learning to grab little foods. Like, that's how babies learn how to, like, use their hands. You know, learning the alphabet is how you learn words. Like, you need somebody to help teach you the basics to then get you to where you're kind of self-sufficient and on your own. It's the same in AA. I have no idea how to do Alcoholics Anonymous. If I did it my way, I'd probably be drunk. And so that's why, sorry. Clearly on my computer. Okay, there we go. I'll have to call it back. So that's why sponsorship to me is so important, is I needed somebody to guide me through this because I was already so broken. And so I needed somebody to walk me through this. And not only that, but I needed someone to help me get to the real kind of foundation of the program, which is not only in the big book, but it says, like, it's finding a higher power. Finding a higher power is what's, like, it's what the big book was made for. And that's what helps me to have relationships with others. And that's what helps me to stay sober. So it's all connected. That's why I need a sponsor. And as far as sponsorship style, I sponsor my sponsees the same way I was sponsored. That's just kind of how my sponsorship family does things. Like, because you'll hear you find someone that you want what they have, right? You find someone the way they're living, you want what they have. So I'm learning that from my sponsor. And so I live the same way she does. Now, I will say this, my sponsor, like, she goes to more meetings than I do. She sponsors more people than I do. Like, that stuff is okay. What I mean is, like, the fundamentals of the program. Like, you'll hear all types of ways of people, how they go through the steps. Some are like, oh, I did a step a month. Some are like, I did them right away. Some are like, oh, I waited. You'll hear all different experiences with that. So my style of sponsorship is this. I'm not one, and my sponsor has never been one to, like, cuss at me, hang up on me, take the, like, hard hand on that. She's definitely been the one where she's like, you about done beating yourself into the ground? Like, she'll definitely tell me the truth. She does not shy away from telling me the truth. But it's not in a way where it's like that authoritative figure. I mean, I was diagnosed with, like, oppositional defiance disorder, which, like, I already don't like authority. I don't like authority, hence my disdain for the police, judges, bosses, and really anybody who thought they were telling me what to do. So that's not my sponsor style of sponsorship, but how I sponsor, it really comes down to two things. Take them through the steps and try to show love. Like, those are my two fundamentals of sponsorship. Like, my job is to take you through the steps and to try to show you love and grace. Like, that's really what it boils down to.
Thank you.
My answer to that is I really only get to know God when I get close to his kids. And I learn so much from being a sponsor. And I've learned so much about my own experience. It's just such a gift to be able to share that and to share my time. I literally used to hate sponsoring before the past few years. Like I thought, oh, I hate this. I'm bad at this. Because I thought I was doing it. Somehow my power was transmitting it, you know, that I had to have all the right answers and do it all. And I've learned so much thanks to my sponsor, Renee, for sending me to the tradition specifically for. I think, and everyone I sponsor is a little different. I mean, I do the fundamental kind of same things, but everybody's moving at a different pace. I don't dictate that pace, but it is my job to make room in my life for them. Which is, you know, I don't like doing that sometimes. Sometimes I don't want to take the time, but man, I always am so glad that I did. Every time I get off the phone or get done with the meeting, I'm so happy that I've taken that time. And my sponsor, you know, Dave had a different approach with sponsorship. We're all kind of doing the same thing, but he just did not get rattled. I get rattled and emotional and weird and Renee was just very helpful. Like, girl, all you got is your experience. That's it. It's all you got. Bottom of page 18 or 19 talks about, or 18 talks about like no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. That are the conditions that we found most comfortable. And so when I first started to be a sponsor, I thought I had to lecture and tell. And it's not, I'm sharing. That's it. I'm sharing my time. I'm sharing what I know about the book. I'm sharing what I've done before them. And it's worked out a whole lot better. The past like 3 or 4 years of being a sponsor has become more of a fulfilling, peaceful experience of like, and not being able to have any, you know, I can't decide who's going to get sober or not. I just show up and be available. My sponsor's always reminding me of that. But thank God I am a sponsor because that's what makes me go to my sponsor so much more. So I'm asking her, hey, did I handle that right? Did that feel right to you? This is what I said. This is what's happening with them. Are we on the right path? Is that okay? And because of being a sponsor, I am actively more sponsored, which I think Sarah was also saying. Great questions, Billy.
Yeah, and I would say too, I completely agree with you. The last couple of years have really changed, probably like the last 4 or 5 years have totally changed my ideas of sponsorship. And I think one thing that is not talked about as much in meetings is like struggling with like being a sponsor. And I had this idea that like the more people you sponsor means the more sober you are. Like I somehow equated like how many people you sponsor to like how sober you are. And then what I ended up finding out was that like I have two sponsees right now and they bring me, and especially in the last 6 months, they have brought me more serenity and more peace and joy and love and just like just reminders of like why I do this than I have ever had in my sobriety. I don't know that I would be sober right now without them, with what's been going on the last 6 months. And I struggle. I mean, when I hear things like people doing them wrong on the phone, I mean, there's one of my sponsees specifically, like I would call my sponsor after I talked to her, rageful at these people that I perceive like hurting her and, you know, wanting to fight her back. I mean, my sponsor, I was like a dang pit bull. Like my sponsor was talking me off a ledge here. Like, no, don't call that person. It's none of your damn business. Like put the phone down. Like, no, don't send that text message or that email putting that person in their place. You know, like it was hard for me because I got so, and on the phone, I'm like, be principled, you know, love and light and live by the principle and do this. And then I'm getting off the phone, like rage calling my sponsor because I want to fight their battles for them because I just love them so dang much. And like I've struggled with that a lot, like on the sponsorship side, and just feeling like sometimes wanting also to shake them and be like, why don't you get it? It's right in front of you. And that's where that whole idea of like, this is not Save the Whales came in with my sponsor. Like, she's like, you think I was, for an example, I was in a really toxic relationship when I first got sober. for years and years and years. And I mean, for probably 4 years. And my sponsor never said a word about it, like a negative. She constantly just pushed me to the principles and looking at my side of the street and all of that. And then now that I'm like married and like it's been like 10, like almost, you know, 10 years since that relationship or whatnot. One day I remember we were talking and it was in the last couple of months and she was like, I'm taking off my sponsorship hat right now and I'm putting on my friend hat. And I was like very taken aback by that. I was like, what do you mean? We're not, what are we not friends? Like she was like, you're taking it too literally. And she just said, watching you go through that was some of the hardest, like in the years that I sponsored you, it was so incredibly difficult watching you let yourself be treated a certain way and me knowing that it could be so much better. I mean, she was like, and I asked her, I was like, well, why didn't you say something? And she said, because it wasn't my job to say something. You needed to figure that out on your own. I needed to help get you to having a relationship with a higher power so that you wanted better for yourself, so that you wanted to do this. And I was like, oh, okay. So that's why I do think it's also important for people that are sponsoring to like talk about the struggles with sponsorship on like the back end as well.
Amen.
Well, this is wonderful. I really appreciate what y'all are sharing. Let's see. The next question I have is, why is consistency in meetings so important? Anybody want to bite on that one?
I'll bite it. I did not think I would ever be a creature of routine or that I would find security in doing the same thing, but I have become that person the longer I've stayed sober. Now, I have a lot of flexibility in my life. Well, before this whole time, now I have like more. I can go to meetings all over the world, but I used to, you know, my life has gotten so big that there's so many options that sometimes I get short-circuited by all the options and just choose not to do anything. Like on Friday night, there's 5 or 6 meetings that I really would love to go to, and it's very difficult to make a decision which one I venture off to. But to have Wednesday night be my home group night, that's a perfect night that I always go to that meeting. And I also know that Stephen's going to be sitting where he's sitting, and Billy's going to be sitting where he's sitting, and Dick is going to be sitting where he sits. And I remember that. I remember that most of the meetings are somebody's home group, and most people, well, a lot of people seem to sit in the same meeting place or be in the same spot of the room. Monday night hashery, you know, I know Kate's going to be back in the back, and I know Daniel's going to be up in the front right. And I know, you know, there's people that I can count on. AA was the first consistent thing I've ever done in my life, and it still is. That's important. It's important for new people to see us. I'm always in the front, in the middle of at hatchery. But all the, you know, I know where my little anchors are, and it gives me comfort. But also, I have something to look forward to every Wednesday night. You know, I do love, you know, meeting up with Sponsee before that meeting, going over to the home group, being in that room with those people. You know, there's just something very safe and consistent about it that I crave.
Mm. I appreciate that so much, Kelly. And I can speak from it. And again, I am one that I just share open and honestly. I can speak from it from the other end of the spectrum. Meeting consistency is the thing I have struggled with the most over the last 6 months. After everything that happened, I just didn't want to go to meetings anymore. I think part of it was seeing other people that kind of knew what was going on, and that made me sad. And then I just didn't want to go to meetings. And so I lost a lot of the meeting consistency. It's not something that I'm like, you know, proud of, but it is definitely something that I struggled with because I lost a lot of the meetings that I went to, even my home group. I stopped going to my home group. I was not doing the consistency thing. And this is like 13 and a half years sober, you know, like, and two things kind of happened. One is that one of my sponsees also struggles with meeting consistency because of a lot of life circumstances. So, you know, how can I go to this person and tell her to do something that I'm not doing? But two, I can also make it more relatable to her. I understand what you're going through. Like, it's something that I struggle with too. And so that's helped. But I think the meeting consistency, why it's so important, is twofold for, in my experience. One, it's somewhere where other people know that I'm going to be. Because when you give of yourself, like, freely, people want your time. And I think that that's one of the greatest blessings of AA, is that you're able to, like, share your experience with others. So, like, I need to go, that's a 12 step for me. Just being at meetings, being there consistently, being an open book for other people to talk to is part of the 12 step. The second piece is the meeting consistency for me. If I know that I'm supposed to be somewhere, it's like service. I'm supposed to be there. I go there every week. They expect me to be there. It's a little extra layer of insurance for my sobriety. And it's a place that I know that I can go, that if stuff does hit the fan, I can go there and I can find peace. If stuff is going amazingly and I'm just so happy, I can go there and I can find peace. But consistency builds relationships. And like, the more consistent that I am, the bigger, the better the relationships. That's what I have found. And so it's been a struggle even recently, because right when I started getting consistent again, COVID happened. And so now it's like we're quarantined, and like making it a priority to get to the Zoom meetings and making it a priority to participate in the Zoom meetings, like keeping the same consistency, even in the times that we're in now, is also still very important. But I think the biggest thing about consistency is that when you're trained to do something, and this is just like the real truth of it, when I'm trained to be at a meeting, if stuff hits the fan and something real bad happens and I'm struggling, when my feet are trained, I go to the meeting anyway. And so I'm safe anyway. And I think that that's why it has come in handy so much recently, is that my feet are trained. And it's the same. Going to meetings consistently is the same importance as calling your sponsor consistently. Because then when stuff hits the fan, you're not afraid to call your sponsor because your fingers are trained to call. So I think consistency has been key, and it's something I'm struggling with currently. So it's not like it's just newcomers who need it. It's everybody.
Amen, girl.
Okay. All right. Next question. Is the first step the most important step?
I'm just going to say this. I might be causing a little bit of causing a little stir. I don't think any step is the most important step. That's just my personal experience, my personal opinion. I don't think any step is more important than any other. I would not have the fulfilled sobriety that I have if I hadn't worked all 12 steps. And truly, I believe only a dummy goes to a 12-step program and doesn't complete the 12 steps. Like, it's just like, only, like, that's, how can I say that AA isn't working? Because that's my war cry, right? Like, AA, it doesn't work. Like, I don't feel better. AA doesn't work. And like, I'm on step four. You know what I'm saying? Like, how, only a dummy thinks something doesn't, like a 12-step program doesn't work without going through the 12 steps. So, I personally don't think that any step is more important. Like, the eighth and ninth step is where I felt the most change. Of course, I wouldn't have gotten there had I not had a first step. I do think that the first step, I don't think I agree with the first step is the only thing you have to do perfectly. I would say the first step is the only thing that you truly have to believe to start this, is what I would say about the first step. But it is very important, but I think all the steps are important. So that's just my experience.
Yeah. Great. Kelly?
Yeah, I think I know why that slogan is there. I mean, I get it. Without being powerless over alcohol and having an unmanageable life, I am not going to do anything different. Mm-hmm. I am not going to swallow my pride and try to make amends and, you know, try to have a relationship with God and meditate, pray, mm-hmm. and help others. I'm not going to do any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, because I wasn't a big dummy that went to 12-step programs that did not work the steps and then said it didn't work. But I'm very glad that I was wrong about that and many, many other things. So I get where that slogan comes from. And it kind of goes back to like the singleness of purpose piece, that like, if you're not an alcoholic, you know, you're not going to do this stuff. And, I mean, if you're not desperate not to go back to the person you were, you're not going to want to be willing to change. So it's kind of that important. I also know that when you drink, it interrupts the connection with higher power. So like, staying sober is super, super important to stay on the path.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, next question. What is a home group? What is a home group?
I think it's really simple. How I found my home group, because I think that's also part of the question. It's just a meeting that I go to consistently where I can be of service and also get the help that I need. That's what I think a home group is. It's also awesome if you have a service position at that said home group. And what a home group is for me is it's just a place where people know me, where I am held accountable and I can help carry a message. And that's how I found my home group is I found the meeting that I feel that the most. And my home group has changed over my, 13 years. Like at one point I moved to another state. So obviously it changed, but like even now, because I'm especially stubborn. I've told you guys that about 50 bajillion times, but there will be times that I might not like a situation, which I then associate with a person, which I then associate with a meeting. So then because I'm just, that's how I do things in my brain. So like, oh, I don't like you. And so that means I don't like this group, which means I don't like this A meeting, so I'm not going there anymore. Like, I've done that with my own home group. And so I've been like, I'm going to a new home group. You guys can't tell me what to do. You know, like, I've done that in society. And so I've had many different home groups. You know, there was a period of time just recently in the last year where a 9:30 a.m. women's meeting on Sunday became my home group because I was so resentful at my own home group. Which I wasn't resentful at my home group. I was resentful at a person and I didn't treat that resentment and it grew to include an entire meeting. Like, and that's crazy. If you can hate, when you have to write a 4-step on 400 people, something is wrong with you. It's not 400 people. So that's when you know that it's you. And that's when I knew it wasn't my home group. It was a person in my home group. And so I do think that home group is important. It's just been recently where I've really started to, in the last couple of months, where I've really started to start going back to my home group consistently. And I have felt that, you know, like these are my people again.
Same. I had another home group. I had a closed meeting that was a women's group for my home group for about 5 years. And I ended up leaving that home group because I felt like the group was getting kind of sick, you know, and I felt like it wasn't very inclusive to a new person and it wasn't very good. I didn't know how much good work was being done in that group. And I ended up making the decision to go become a part of a big book study that I was a much more inclusive group that feels a lot safer for the people that come in the door. And that I feel like I can do a lot of good work at. I have been doing, and I can consistently make. That is a very important one, is to choose a meeting. You know, I prayed about leaving that women's group for a long time, I was not sure if I was making the decision because I was afraid or if I was making a decision because I had a resentment. You know, I just wasn't sure which direction to go. And then lo and behold, I'm working the registration door at the Bull and Oyster Roast here. And these guys I haven't seen in a while come in, these old timers, and they tell me about a big book study they just started, and it was all men and they needed some women. And it was the same night, 30 minutes earlier than that other women's meeting. And I was like, when that happened, they asked me to be a part of the group. And, that was my answer to prayer. It was like, God was like, okay, here you go. Do this. And I made the decision to change, you know, I prayerfully did that, you know, but, I started going to this group and it is just rock solid. It's the most inclusive, melting pot of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like the group is just people from all walks of life are in the circle sometimes. And I just get so welled up by looking around at like all the different types of people that it's just so inclusive. But yeah, I do a lot of good work there. I have a job there. I feel safe there. And when I miss it, I miss it. Like I've had an opportunity to travel and when I can't make the meeting, I feel like I'm missing something. That's how I know it's my home group.
Mm-hmm. All right. Wonderful. Thank you. Okay. Y'all still got some steam? We got some more questions?
Sure.
When should you take the steps? I have heard everything from taking one a month to waiting a year.
No.
That's up.
I'm a hard no on waiting a year. That's just my personal experience. I don't think anywhere in the book does it tell you this is when you should start the steps. So I'll just speak to what my experience is. I could be wrong about that. It might say, and I mean, I know that they have the things where like at once we, but that's like within the steps. So I personally, the meat and potatoes of Alcoholics Anonymous, we have this triangle, unity, service, and recovery. So unity, I mean, I think AA does such an amazing job of being so inclusive and being a place of with having unity and, you know, you're welcome here. You're welcome here. Come on in. You're welcome here. Service, it's, you know, just do this. And when I was new, the service that I did was like, oh, this person was like, I'm picking you up, but I'm picking up 17 hours before the meeting because we've got to do about 30 bajillion things to set up the meeting, which made me rageful. I was like, who goes to a, and I'll stop being dramatic, but who goes to a meeting 2 hours before the actual meeting? In what world does that make sense? That's how I felt when I was new, but that's neither here nor there. That's how I got into service, was doing it with other people getting picked up. But the recovery piece of this, the recovery is in the big book. It is the 12 steps in the big book. That's the recovery piece. It is the base of everything. So I see no point in, if you're here and you're ready to do this, like, and okay, you're here, you're seemingly willing in this hour. It could change tomorrow, understandably, but right now you're in it. Why not get started on the steps? Why not give yourself the best benefit? Like, God is in. You're letting God in right now. You're at a meeting. Like, you're letting God in. Why wait until that door potentially closes and you're off on your next spree? That's just been my, that was also my experience, because when I was waiting to do the steps, when I wasn't immediately jumping into the steps, I relapsed. I would go back out. This time around, I got into the steps and I haven't gone back out. Now, is that the only reason why I haven't gone back out? Probably not. Why would I test the waters? You know, like, so I've had this experience where I jumped right into the steps and I was able to stay sober this time. So that's what I do with the girls that I sponsor. We get into the steps right away.
Yeah, same. I would say the year waiting a year to do a step is just terrible. That's my opinion, but I think that's terrible, terrible direction. Probably made by well-intended people, but would kill me. You know, the depth and weight piece, like, that is the whole reason we're together in this. That's the whole reason this person is in my life or I'm in that person's life, is because I want them to work the steps with me, or I've been asked to work the steps with them. So that is the bonding ingredient that keeps us on a path, right? That is the thing. Now, I don't rush anybody. I let them kind of, you know, page 18 and 19 are pretty powerful. There's like how to be a sponsor, like, and how to be tolerant of other people. Like, when I was struggling with sponsorship, my sponsor sent me the Tradition 4 thing, and the checklist was like, you know, we go to their links, not ours. Now, I can guide them along and say, here, I'm going to give you this assignment. I want to hear from you in like 2 days. Let's get it done. Right. And at this time, that's working out pretty well. Most people I'm giving assignments, they're able to get it done in 2 days. But, you know, then when I have somebody on the four step, I'm still, you know, trying to reach out and make sure they're actually writing and they're still part of it. They're still communicating with me and they're not just dipping out of the work, you know. I feel like it's a two-way street in that way, but I don't rush them. I let them have their own experience. But I make sure that is the basis of our communication. It's like, okay, here's an assignment. I will hear that assignment. And from that, these incredible relationships grow. But it's not the other way around. The relationships don't grow just because they grow. It's because of the steps. You know, it's because of that work.
And you're not going, I mean, at least my experience has been, I didn't go through the steps just once. And I know, I remember when I heard, you know, at an old timers meeting that I went to, they were, you know, and I love being able to have open conversation with people that have differing opinions. As long as it's productive, like, there's nothing wrong. There might be someone in this meeting right now who's like, you're totally wrong. You should absolutely wait a year. And if you have that experience, that's actually wonderful. Like, that's the whole point of experience, is that everybody's is different and you will be able to be uniquely useful to somebody else. And so I had a discussion with an old timer who was really adamant about the fact that you let somebody really get sober before you take them through the steps. And my opinion was, but how do they get sober if they're not working the steps to get to the year? Because I never would have been able to stay sober a year. I definitely would have been either lying about it and drinking on the side, or just been like, buzz off, this is crazy. And we just had like a conversation about it. And I think that's what was so productive, was being able to have that conversation and see differing sort of, and his thing was, well, then you work the steps and then you're good after a year. And I was like, oh, okay, see, I worked the steps immediately, and then I've worked them again and again and again throughout my sobriety, and it's been different every time. And, like, I know that there were some girls that I have sponsored that, you know, like, right, they're not moving forward with a certain step right now because they've got a life circumstance going on, and, like, that's okay, we'll address it. It's just, it's different for everybody, and it doesn't. But I think that the initial for me is that I needed to get right into the steps, and I try to take the girls that I sponsor right through the steps too, so they can get the meat and potatoes of the program. Understanding you're going to go through the steps again in 2 years, and you might have a completely different third step. Your inventory is obviously going to be, your resentment inventory is going to be different. I mean, I was resentful towards all types of different people in my second and third, fourth step. And my amends are different. You know, everything, I had more amends that I had to make in sobriety. Those are painful too. The amends that you have to make to things you've done in sobriety, to people in sobriety, whew, those are the painful ones most recently. So, but yeah, it's like, I'm not going through the steps just one time. So let's get me sober with them, the meat and potatoes of the program. And then if I can go through and do them again.
Okay. All right. Both of y'all have touched on this one already, but maybe have a specific experience you want to share. What is your relationship with the 11th step?
Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, you go ahead, Kelly.
Okay. My relationship is, I have a very healthy relationship with step 11 right now. And I have for the past couple of years of really being able to get quiet with my own brain. And it wasn't until I worked steps and got all that crap out was I able to, like, get quiet at all. But I found a concoction that works very well for me, which is, you know, putting these headphones on and listening to some sounds and closing my eyes. I can close my eyes and, like, almost instantly connect with God and get quiet, get internally stiller. And like I said, I bring my notebook and, you know, I sit there and things come to me as I'm in my meditation practice. I think of things I need to do or I should give my assistant to do. I literally rely on it. I rely on prayer and meditation. I rely on my intuitive thoughts and those decisions. I have that vital sixth sense. I get it. I get what they're talking about. When I get quiet, I mean, I can, you know, hear all kinds of stuff, but it takes time, it takes practice. And I have to continue to come and do what's working for me. And that, you know, those situations change. You know, I travel, I'm not always able to sit in my orange chair. You know, sometimes I have to do it somewhere else. And I don't like change. I do it best in my chair. I come back to this chair at 3 p.m. some days when I'm really tired. You know, my sponsor's a big one for getting quiet more than once a day when I'm really busy. Another one of those AA paradoxes. Like, when you're really unmanageable, your life is going really, really fast, you need to get quiet twice, like, more than once a day. And sometimes I can just pour myself in this chair, come out from the studio, sit down, close my eyes, take a couple deep breaths, and start getting that calm, that centered again, which is just amazing. But I didn't have it in the beginning. I used to hate sitting in quiet. Oh God, I used to hate it. I used to not be able to stem the thoughts, you know, and that's the miracle of what we do here is that the brain that I came to you guys with is still the same brain I have, but it's been treated. And when it's treated, I can get quiet. It's pretty awesome. Sarah, what do you do?
So, I have a new, over the last 6 months, I've developed a new appreciation for my 11 step. So when I was first sober, I had no frickin' idea how to do an 11 step. But I was someone that needed that pause that comes from the 11 step so badly because I would say things as they came to my brain. So I clearly did a lot of damage because if I thought it, I said it. And if I didn't say it, I showed it all over my face. And so, I needed that pause to come, and that pause that people talk about where, like, you want to restrain a tongue and pen, that comes from an 11 step. At least that's been my experience. It really came from my 11 step. So I needed it. And I was just especially stubborn. And so what my sponsor, and there is a guy who, Thomas, who's really, who's got a good, decent, like a large amount of time sober, they pointed me to the big book. And what they pointed me to was in the 11th step in the big book, it actually gives you play by play directions. It literally says like, upon awakening, we do this. Throughout the day, we do this. Before you retire, do this. So if you, I needed that help. And if somebody else is struggling with it, it's actually laid out for you where to start in the big book, exactly what to do. And like, that's what I needed. And so that's where I started. And, that was sort of, that's where I started the prayer, the conversation with God. So that's where I'm talking to God. And then it's sort of grown into me. And as I was saying in my story, like what it's grown into is that I just have open conversations with God. Like I don't need to kneel down to do that. I just do it whenever I need it, whether it's I roll out of bed and I'm not someone that does that, but it could be that like if I needed to roll out of bed, get on my knees and talk to God, I could do that. If I'm brushing my teeth, I can talk to God. If I'm driving a car, I can talk to God. If I'm at work and I need a moment, I can go into a stairwell and talk to God. Like I just have open communication with God. And that's what I believe prayer is, and that's what it is for me right now. As far as the meditation, that for me is when I find the peace and quiet in the head of voices that are all my voice inside of my own head, where I can actually listen and where I can see God working in my life. Because that's what meditation helps me does. It helps me to slow down, take a step back and see where God is working in my life so that I can then have a little bit more peace and like understand that God is speaking to me usually through people and that things are going to be okay. And that's where I sort of find my quiet. And that's where I'm able to get back to like, things are going to be okay. Like it's going to be okay. And it's also where I find that pause because I still need that pause today. Like I still need that pause very much today. And that restraint has come from meditation.
Okay. Wow. Well, we have actually come to the end of our hour. I still have a list of questions, but I think we're about done. So, you know, this has been a wonderful day. It's been a wonderful event again. Thank both of you ladies so much. I personally just identify with not only the language of the heart, the spirit of what you each had to share, but so many personal individual details I just resonate with. It's just a joy. And because of this, I feel a little bit closer, a little bit more a part of, a little bit less apart from. And I'm just so grateful that we've all had this time together. This has been a blessed 3.5 hours or 3 hours. Yeah, 3.5 hours for us to all be together. So thank you so very much.